Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies podcast, which operates online through the New Books Network. I am Sher Ali Tareen, your host. Shanila Khoja Moolji's Forging an Ideal Educated Girl is a path-paving and incredibly timely monograph that combines tools of education studies, gender studies, and post-colonial genealogy to interrogate the promises and paradoxes invested in the idea of girls' education. Shifting her camera of analysis between global discourses on female education and empowerment and the translation of those discourses in the form of educational policies, cultural developments, and political maneuverings in post-colonial societies like Pakistan, Khoja Moolji masterfully unveils the fraught nature of an otherwise often taken for granted ideal of girls' education. Through a close and careful reading of varied and often colorful state and non-state archives, this book traces the often contingent and contradictory projects of nationalism and citizenship reflected in competing imaginaries of the ideal of an educated girl over time, with a focus on the context of Pakistan. This remarkably lucid text will be widely read by scholars of education, gender, South Asia, and post-colonial thought, and will also make an excellent choice for undergraduate and graduate seminars. Here now is my conversation with Professor Shanila Khoja Moolji. Hello, Shanila. How are you doing?
Hi, Shirley. I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's such a pleasure to have you on New Books, on the New Books Network. And thank you so much for this incredibly important and well-written and theoretically sharp and lucid book. So really looking forward to this conversation. We have a tradition on the New Books Network, Shanila, that our first question is always biographical. Could you share with our listeners a bit some sense of your intellectual journey, how you became a scholar of gender, Islam, Muslim societies, South Asia, and how you got to write this particular book?
Sure. So, as you know, I am originally from Pakistan. And I think that scholarship often in some ways is autobiographical. And so during my master's, I started thinking about women in Muslim contexts, particularly in Pakistan. And I had a chance to work with Leila Abulugad to look at women's piety movements in Pakistan. But as I moved to my doctoral program at Columbia, I started thinking a little bit more about this convergence on the figure of the girl in international development policy and practice. And so you'll find that in a lot of development campaigns today, girls in the global south, they are portrayed as not only threatened by poverty, disease, and terrorism, but also holding the potential to resolve these very problems. Education is often presented as this sort of primary social practice that can help girls to reinvent themselves and achieve their potential. And so during my doctoral program, I was writing a lot about how the black and brown girl figures in these development campaigns to look at the kinds of promises that she makes for societies, but also to look at how she actually circulates in the global north. I was particularly interested in pointing out how the burden of development and ending poverty is being shifted onto girls, which also in crucial ways kind of depoliticizes and ahistoricizes poverty in these particular contexts. But as I was doing this work and thinking a little bit more about it, I was reminded about this enticement of the figure of the educated girl, that it's not a new phenomena. It's actually, there is the appearance of the Musalman woman in colonial archives and all sorts of social entities and reformers were interested in the education of the Musalman woman as well. So you'll find colonial administrators, Christian missionaries, and also Muslim social reformers, who all, for different reasons, they wanted to also imagine that education would save, civilize, or reform native women. And so for the book, I decided to trace these different articulations about the figure of the educated girl in the context of colonial India and Pakistan, because those are the contexts that I'm most familiar with, and I had the language skills to go into looking at the archives as well. And so I wanted to just look at how this figure appears in that part of the world. What are some of the conversations that were happening internal within the colonial Indian and then later Pakistani context? And what does she promise for whom? And how is she supposed to be educated? And what are the politics around that?
Terrific. So let's begin with a broad question that has to do with the larger goals of the book. Perhaps I could have you reflect on the title of the book, which part of which is Forging the Ideal Educated Girl. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how this title connects with the broader conceptual goals and themes of the book, some of which you've already talked about.
Right.
And in what ways does this whole discourse, I mean, clearly this is a project that, you know, travels from the 19th century to the early decades of the new nation state of Pakistan. But in what ways do we see this kind of discourse persist even today in, you know, both the Global South and the Global North?
Right. So as I mentioned, so if we were to think of the figure of the educated girl as discursively produced, and that's how I imagine the figure of the educated girl, so I'm not trying to look at particular girls and their lives, but I'm actually looking at how different entities and social reformers talk about this girl, locate this girl in and through text and visualities. And so that was one of the reasons why I chose this sort of term around forging the ideal educated girl, and to look at how is she formed, where is she placed, how is she described, and crucially, how does this articulation shift over time? And so you'll see in the book that I try to map different kinds of articulations. So the book is divided into three different periods. We're looking at the turn of the 20th century, the early decades after the political establishment of Pakistan, and then the turn of the 21st century. And within each of these periods, I'm trying to also map at different articulations of the educated girl. And I argue that the articulations that take that become most salient or become most dominant are also an effect of relations of power. But at the same time, also point to the fact that there is no one sort of idea. There are multiple articulations vying for dominance. And so because the book tries to track some of these contestations, I thought it would be interesting to imagine this sort of enterprise as an attempt to forge particular kinds of girlhood. And to the second part of your question, I think these ideas are quite prominent still today. As I mentioned, I think the international development regime is one of the most prominent spaces and sites where you will find articulations of ideal girls, particularly through discourses on education, but also discourses on lifestyle skills. That's a big thing these days. You also find other idioms in and through which girls are to be saved or reformed. I'm teaching a course in politics of girlhood at Bowdoin these days, and we are currently talking about the discourse on child marriage and how the figure of the child bride is also a fairly racialized and religion subject, and how the discourse on child marriage is used to also mark particular girls as needing saving. The discourse on female genital mutilation is another one that I've been writing about, around how particular girls are centered in that discourse. And then menstrual hygiene campaigns, that's another idiom in and through which we can imagine these the wretched state of Black and brown girls who are expected to be saved and reformed, and they have to be taught how to maintain their bodies, to contain their bodily fluids, etc. And crucially, in a separate sort of line of inquiry, I'm also arguing around how these discourses of producing particular imaginations of girls and then reshaping them are also taken up in political and penalizing discourses of, say, the immigration and border policing discourses in the U.S. and in Europe as well. And so this incitement is, as I think it's a very sort of prominent, it appears differently. And the girl is being forged in these different multiple sites across the world. Yeah.
Terrific. So one of the major strengths of this book that I found was that not only is it centered in the contemporary context, but it is also historically grounded. And you begin actually in colonial India to look at some of the beginnings of this discourse of the ideal female subject. So I have a couple of questions on that part of your book. So let's focus first on these writings that you focus on by, you know, for lack of a better word, Muslim male elite writings on the ideal female subject. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about, I know you look at multiple kinds of writings, but if you could use a couple of examples to speak about the kinds of arguments that we find in these texts, and what was the broader context in which this whole form of textual production took place in colonial India. Let's focus first on the male Muslim writers before we move to the female ones for the next question.
Sure. So as you know, this period is, it's marked by increasing anxiety on the part of elite social classes. They had previously enjoyed privileges in the Mughal courts, but after the entrenchment of the British rule, they were now struggling to, in some ways, preserve their social status. And so one of the things we find is that there is a way to rethink elite status or sharafat in and through women and their social practices. And so the emergence of women is another site in and through which the elites could signal their social class. And that's why you'll find a range of reformers, religious reformers, more modernists, also nationalists, who are trying to imagine their futures and their desired sort of social status in and through the figure of the educated woman. And so there are lots of writings that I write about in the book. I think in terms of male social reformers, you'll find that Sir Sayyid Ahmed Khan, he argued that it was not necessary to invest in the public education of women. He broadly believed that Muslims needed to study the English language and Western sciences in order to recover their status in India. But he overall emphasized the education of boys over girls, and he believed that girls could get an education at home through their male relations. But what happens is that by the late 19th, early 20th century, there is a sort of wave of social reformers who are actively working with the British government as well to thinking about education of women. A lot of times they're trying to raise funds for government schools or for Islamic schools, or articulating for greater provision of funds so that female teachers could be hired to teach elite women at home. And so there is one particular reformer, Mumtaz Ali, who advocates in his work, it's called Hukuk and Iswan, and he calls for giving access to all sort of forms of education, all forms of knowledges to women, because they share the same intellectual faculties as men. He also wanted to enable women to develop the skills that were necessary for becoming a better and a more interesting companion to their husbands. And so there is this sort of distinct new subject that is emerging where we find the woman as a homemaker, a companion, a child rearer, right? So this sort of imagination around women emerges. And that subject requires specific training, and social and elite male reformers are writing about that as well. There is also some reformers make allowances for women to get an education that might allow them to engage in paid labor. And in that context, I find Aga Khan III's work very interesting. And I really love one of his quotes, and I'm going to read it now. So he basically is talking to his female followers, and he says, quote, "I am trying to guide our young women's lives into entirely new channels. I want to see them able to earn their living in trades and professions so that they're not economically dependent on marriage, nor a burden on their fathers and brothers," unquote. And so I argue that the social reformers are also writing with particular constituencies in mind. The Aga Khan likely is writing and has at the forefront the welfare of his female followers, who likely came from lower socioeconomic classes. And so the need for education for paid work may have been greater in that space. And so you find him writing from that sort of subject position. We also have Ashraf Ali Thanvi, the ulama from the Deoband Madrasa. He was unwilling to compromise on the prevalent sort of practices of seclusion, and so he argued for increasing women's basic literacy skills, just so that they're able to communicate with the outside world and engage in religious practice. And so all of these different sorts of views on what women, what type of knowledges are needed for women, also influenced the pathways that these male reformers sort of identified for women. So Ashraf Ali Thanvi, for example, wrote books, and he imagined that women would not leave the zanana to acquire education, and that this literature was enough for them. Whereas Aga Khan III, he actually established schools for girls in remote parts of Pakistan, because he imagined that girls will have to leave some of these spaces to actually go to schools and to get an education. And so there's a lot of they're competing imaginations of what type of knowledges women need. And so they also bring forth different kinds of sort of material interventions.
And how about such texts by female Muslim authors?
Right.
You could give an example or two how they might be similar to, but also might differ from the ones that you just very nicely described.
Right. I think what was most interesting for me was that I found that women also were similarly... their views on education were fairly similar to those of men, and they were not also united on this front. And so you will find women who were really adamant that they did not want to leave the zanana to acquire knowledges, and so they called for establishments of funds so that they could hire female teachers or ustanis to come at home. But there were also women who believed adamantly, and so I've analyzed these women's writings in magazines, right? And so this is where I'm sort of gleaning this these views from. And so there were women who wanted access to British schools because they believed that they needed to learn the sciences and the English language, and there was no other way for them to progress or for the qaum to progress without access to such knowledges. And then there were other women who... wanted the establishment of Islami schools, so Muslim schools for girls, and they often used to call out male social reformers for not investing enough effort in raising funds for these types of schools as they were doing for men at that same time. And so there was a lot of internal conversation around how Muslim social reformers, male social reformers, had to step up and to provide resources for women too, in much the similar ways that they were doing for men. In the book, I analyze and work through the writings of Mohammadi Begum in particular. She has she's a pioneer sort of Muslim writer in Urdu, but also an editor. She has a range of texts, and some of them are specifically about the education of girls, and they're written for girls. And so I look at a text called Sugar Bedi, Sharif Bedi, and then some of the other texts in which she's talking about this Ghafil Larki, the ignorant girl. And I look at how each of these figures is classed in particular ways, which also means that she's called on to acquire skills that would help her to reproduce her social class, in addition to the fact that she has to care for parents, be a pious woman, etc. And so in the book, I highlight some of these different imaginations around these girls, which actually produce these girls as well as class subjects.
Terrific. So now let's move to the part of your book in which you talk about Pakistan and its early years. And so in what ways was this discourse of an ideal woman, how did it become a part of Pakistan's modernization drive during its early decades, which is one of the major focuses of the second part of your book? And in what ways did these sorts of state projects and discourses, how did they authorize the production of a certain kind of nationalist femininity or a nationalist vision of the ideal Muslim woman? So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about this chapter of your book in which you talk about how this whole discourse of the ideal Muslim woman gets mapped onto and folded into this whole modernization drive during the early decades of the Pakistani nation state.
Right. So this is the time where we find a lot of discussion about what does it mean to be a Pakistani citizen. There's also discussions around the need for the nation to modernize, to become technologically and scientifically advanced, and also and concerns around, okay, what is the role of Islam going to be in this new nation? And so we find a lot of writing, not only by these newly created citizens in women's magazines and newspapers, but also the emerging bureaucracy and state leaders, all of whom are trying to imagine what would the new citizenry look like and what are the needs. And so some of the things, so I look at early state documents around education policies to understand how education was to forge Pakistani citizens who would be trained to partake in the development and modernization of Pakistan. And within this sort of discourse, we also find the emergence of these idealized figures. And so women appear as mothers of future citizens, and that's why they need good education and they need to be brought into the sphere, the education sphere. But also an articulation of women as daughter workers. And so particularly middle class and low income women are being called on to participate in the industries, the feminized service industries, for example, working as teachers, working as air hostesses, learning psychology, etc. And so the book kind of looks at some of these state-sponsored documents and discourses and political speeches where we find articulations of women as mothers and women as daughter workers. But I also look at this fascinating study that was done with girls during the 1950s, where the author categorizes girls into ultra-modern, modern, and pradhanashin. And so it was fairly interesting because there is this sense that the modern girl is the ideal Pakistani girl. If you are pardanashin and if you practice religion in ways that calls on you to excuse yourself from co-educational settings, that means that you're not actually partaking in the nation building project. And if you are ultra-modern, who is enamored by the West and who learns English but not Urdu, then too you are actually not the ideal female subject that the nation needs. And so that book was very interesting to see how the modern girl is imagined as a subject that is not only that practices piety and religion in specific ways, but also has a very active role in the development of Pakistan during this time period.
And one of the strengths of the book, of course, is that in addition to these state discourses, you also look at the sort of non-state actors of how they also contributed to certain articulations of ideal female educated subjects. And I was particularly intrigued by the ways in which you talked about the articulations of desired and undesired female educated subjects. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about some of these articulations as they emanated from some non-state actors, and what kinds of media did such discourses travel in, and what kinds of domestic and international anxieties were they trying to confront and overcome and pacify in producing this vision of desired and undesired female educated subjects?
Right. So if we take that study that I was just talking about, so you find this notion of the ultra modern girl, and I think that that subject is so some of the things that the ultra modern girl does is that she goes to parties, she probably drinks and smokes, she's enamored by the West, and she looks down upon Pakistanis, she doesn't want to learn the Urdu language, and she wants to practice, she wants to learn English, for example. There's one particular articulation of her as playing piano, for example, and learning how to dance. And so there is this imagination that particular subjects who are not aligned with the nation's goal of developing the nation and progressing the nation and learning the national language, you will recall that the language of Pakistan are at the forefront. And so the imagination is that we need, for those subjects are not desired for the progress of Pakistan. And then there is these other sorts of media, as you mentioned, where there are representations of women that emerge. So PIA advertisement, the Pakistan International Airlines, there you have images of women as air hostesses. But what is most interesting is that as the nation calls on women to enter the waged work domain in order to partake in the nation, in the national progress, it also articulates them in ways that kind of circumscribes their roles. And so the air hostesses, for example, are called on to become air hostesses and apply to PIA to actually work, but they're often articulated as being good for that job, because Pakistani daughters are ideal caregivers. And the fact that they are so good at that, that they can transplant their caregiving skills into this sort of a service of the tourists, for example, right, or the travelers. And so the articulation of women still gets circumscribed, even though some spaces for work become open for women, particularly in the tourism industry and in the education industry to some extent as well.
Now, another, I think, excellent thing about this book is that not only is it attuned to the Pakistani context, but you constantly fluctuate the camera from the specificity of the Pakistani context to global discourses around this whole idea of the empowerment of Muslim girls and women and so forth. And I was wondering if you could comment a bit about this broader global discourse of empowering Muslim girls and women, you know, especially since the example that you gave of the case of Malala Yousafzai and the reproduction of that example in the West. I was wondering how this broader global discourse informs and inflects the Pakistani context, and also what are some of the major conceptual and political problems that might seem, well, you know, obvious to an academic audience, but I think it's still useful to flesh it out in the brilliant ways that you do in your book. So I was wondering if you could speak about this discourse, the global sort of discourse of empowering Muslim girls and women, and then also comment a bit on how it informs the Pakistani context and what are some of the problems with this.
Right. So so as I mentioned earlier, I've been looking at how the figure of the girl is invoked in the international development policy and practice, and particularly the girls' education discourses. And my key, and so of course Malala Yousafzai has become the kind of symbol of girls' education, and of course she's doing amazing work. And so in the past, I've analyze the ways in which she is articulated within these campaigns to call attention to the wretched condition of women in Pakistan, but also in and through that, how Islam and Muslim men are invoked as being uniquely oppressive towards women. And then crucially, how there is this drive to articulate the free market as the primary site in and through which girls can experience empowerment. And so the idea is that you're supposed to go to school, delay marriage, delay bearing children, enter the waged force, waged work, even that if that means working in the sweatshops or factories. So Nicholas Kristof has an article, it's called Two Cheers for the Sweatshop, and how there's, so these are imagined like, I mean, the market is imagined as the primary sort of space that can emancipate and empower girls either through consumption or through waged work. And so that becomes really problematic for me. And I think in a very sort of important way, it depoliticizes poverty and how the conditions that women and girls in these parts of the world are experiencing have become this way in the first place. And so there is it abstracts the current situations from history, and it shifts the burden of development onto girls, which I think is unfair because girls often do not have the scaffolding to elevate themselves and their families and their nations out of these conditions. And so my key concern has been around how we could have a deeper conversation around around education, the purposes of education, but also around poverty and displacement and dispossessions in some of these geographical contexts that are centered in girls' education, transnational discourses.
Now, before I move to the next question, I should mention to the listeners that the book also has some really instructive and interesting images, as you were, especially in relation to the last question of you know the PIA air hostesses from the early decades of the Pakistani nation state, and some really interesting advertisements in both Urdu and in English, which are not only very illuminating but also at times quite hilarious. So I should point that out. So the next question that I have for you, which is sort of the final substantive question, is I wanted to ask you about this study that you analyzed towards the end of your book in South Pakistan on the question of education in religious minorities. Tell us a bit about the major features and findings of that study, and how do those findings undermine these universalizing discourses and claims of girl empowerment through education discourse? In other words, when you look at the local context and its own specific dynamics, as you saw in the study, how do they interrupt this universalizing discourse of girl empowerment through education?
Right. So as you know, I'm from Pakistan. And so I went back to the community where I grew up and have been working in the same context as a researcher and also as a volunteer for over a decade now. And so when I was trying to think about some of the ways in which the promises of girls' education unfold in a local context, I thought that it was most appropriate to go back to where I came from. And so I conducted a few focus groups in this context, and my hope was to engage with girls who are who would self-identify as low income or low middle income from being in those representing those families, and also the community is Shia, and so there are religious minorities as well in the context of Pakistan, and so I wanted to see what their experiences of schooling were and if they actually had a critique of their schooling. There are a few major things that I found. The first thing was around how, and we know this in the field of education, that schooling the consumption of schooling is differentiated by social class. And so the low-income girls from my study often wanted to get an education in order to end up in what they called an office job. In the book, I write about how office job is a code for jobs that might be secure from sexual harassment. These are jobs where you're either working as a teacher or a secretary or a typist or a program officer at an NGO. And so the assumption is that you're not on the roads, and being in these office spaces might actually shield you from harassment as well, which we know is just an imagination that women experience harassment in all these sorts of places as well. But I think there was this sense that that girls desire to end up in those jobs. But the flip side of that is that these office jobs are also fairly classed. And so the group of girls that I was speaking with, they would most likely not end up in these jobs. They would likely end up either in factories, there is a nearby pharmaceutical factory, or they would be engaged in reproductive unpaid tasks, working in the fields, or working as maids in domestic households. There were a couple of girls who ended up in my focus group who are from the upper middle class category, even though I hadn't actively sought that category. And they wanted to acquire an education to find better husbands. They believed that if they inserted doctor or engineer in front of their names, they could entice husbands who were well-placed economically. And so they didn't imagine that education would allow them to enter the workforce because they didn't actually want to enter the workforce. For them, education would allow them a sort of life where they did not have to work. And so Fida Edley has also found similar evidence from Jordan, and the World Bank actually has called this a gender paradox, where girls are consuming education for reasons other than entering the labor force. And so the reason here is marriageability. But coming to some of the critiques that the girls advanced, I think one of the main critiques of school knowledges from girls from the low income or middle income category was around how they were not able to acquire training in hunar, And they described hunar as being skills that might allow them to access work in some ways in the informal sector, but also allow them to figure out ways in which they could secure jobs that were outside of office jobs as well, because implicitly they also understood that office jobs were classed and they probably wouldn't get those and be able to make money through those. And so this critique, I was reading this as a way in which the rise of mass schooling has also led to a sort of consolidation of what can be taught in schools. And in Pakistan now, we find a multi-track sort of education system. So you have public schools and private schools, and then you have technical schools and vocational schools where the girls could have learned some of those skills. But these latter institutions are often where uneducated people go. And so the idea is that even though they desired the schools, which they could have gotten from vocational schools, they couldn't go to these schools because they also didn't want to be labeled as uneducated people. So the final thing is around how some of the participants articulated this critique of schools as failing religious minorities. And so as I had mentioned that my participants were from a religious minority background, they were Shia, and they understood that schools produce the ideal Muslim who is imagined as Sunni. And so schools do this through the Islamiyat curriculum, Pakistan Studies curriculum, teacher appointments, textbooks, dress codes, etc. And so there was an anxiety around how their subject position was erased and their particular interpretation of Islam was not centered in school and what that might mean for them. And so this community, for example, has developed evening religious education schools. So students go to the school in the morning, they come back to their homeworks and then go to the evening religious education centers as well. So I wanted to get at some of the ways in which schools and school knowledge is also failing religious minorities. So overall, then this chapter kind of highlights the possibilities of education for girls, but also some of the limitations that schooling introduces, particularly for girls from low income or religious minority backgrounds.
So as we're coming towards the end of our time, Shanila, could you share a bit with our listeners about what's the next project that you're thinking of working on?
Yes. So I am currently working on extending one of the lines of inquiries that I wrote about briefly in the book. It has to do with the autobiographical text Hayat-e-Ashraf, which is composed by Mohammadi Begum during the early 20th century. And I'm trying to engage with this text to argue how we can reanimate Muslim women's autobiographical writings toward decolonial ends. And so, as you know, the text is quite generous because it has writings from Bibi Ashraf herself, who was one of the earliest Muslim women school teachers, but also her daughter and her editor, Mohammadi Begum herself. And then now I am interacting as a Muslim woman from that part of the world with the text as well. And so I'm trying to see how the text travels across time and continues to teach us lessons about gender and education.
Forging the Ideal Educated Girl, the Production of Desirable Subjects in Muslim South Asia by Professor Shanila Khoja Mulji, published by the University of California Press in 2018. Thank you so much, Shanila, for for this wonderful conversation, for giving us so much to think about, and for such a splendid and important book. So thanks so much.
Thank you for inviting me. Thanks.
So this was my conversation with Professor Shanila Khoja Mulji about her wonderful new book, Forging an Ideal Educated Girl. I hope you enjoyed this interview. And I hope that you will also join us next time for another fresh episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.